It was only a few years ago that the topic of alcoholism was virtually taboo in polite conversation, although its ravages upon physical, mental, and moral fiber were well known. Virtually nothing was said about it at the public level. Even the suffering alcoholic was convinced that he lacked courage and strength of character. The stigma that had been attached to the disease through the ages was perhaps largely responsible for the fact that the only campaign directed against it was waged by well-intentioned but inept reformers. With the advent of Alcoholics Anonymous, the first light was thrown on a subject that had been left in deplorable darkness. A mere handful of courageous victims, aided by a few medical men and clergymen, discovered that any effective treatment of a disease which was threefold in nature would have to be threefold in action, providing physical, mental, and spiritual help simultaneously. Although Alcoholics Anonymous does not publicize the names of its members, it has had its astonishing growth largely because, from the beginning, men and women who found sobriety through its program were selfless and humble in passing the word along to those who still suffered from alcoholism. Father John Doe's story has been an inspiration to thousands, not only because he was the first Catholic priest to join AA, but because he has the gift of pinpointing the emotions and frustrations of the alcoholic and other victims, regardless of age, sex, or background, and to help them recognize the symptoms of the disease in themselves. While there is nothing more tragic than the disintegration of the human being, there is no message that carries more hope than the story of human rehabilitation. Thus it is that whenever a member of Alcoholics Anonymous speaks at an AA meeting, it is practically a universal custom that he first identify himself as an alcoholic. In doing this, he usually retells certain incidents of his past living which indicate that he is an alcoholic. Contrary to common opinion, this is in no way a public confession. It is done for four very definite reasons which experience has taught to be of great value in the maintaining of sobriety in the alcoholic. The first reason is so the listeners may know that the speaker is an alcoholic and therefore qualified to speak at an AA meeting. Hence, the qualification may be as short as simply saying, "I am an alcoholic," or it may be as detailed as the individual himself may choose. The second reason is to offer an opportunity for the alcoholic to achieve a sense of humor towards his past drinking escapades. Fulton Auersler, the well-known writer and newspaper columnist, although he himself was not an alcoholic, points out why this is so in the following words. Quote, "The alcoholic must have a sense of humor. It is only thus that he will be able to reach that godlike state wherein he can laugh at himself, which is the very height of self-conquest. Go to meetings and listen to their laughter. At what are they laughing? At the horrible memories over which weaker souls would cringe in useless remorse." Unquote. The third reason is to help some in the audience who may be looking for the exact pattern that the speaker has to solve their own problems, and to encourage particularly the newcomers in their striving for sobriety. The final reason, which is perhaps the most important, is to help himself. Particularly is it necessary in the repeating of one story to deepen ever more and more the conviction which he dare not ever lose, namely, that he is and will always remain an alcoholic. The following is the qualification of Father John Doe. It has been given to AA groups throughout the United States and Canada. We have knowledge of thousands of individuals who have been greatly helped by hearing this story. Their letters of appreciation and their comments are too numerous to mention. We now bring to you on record this same story with the fond hope that many, many thousands more may be helped in their struggle to obtain and maintain sobriety and to understand alcoholism and the alcoholic. We give you Father John Doe, Alcoholic.
Now, I am a Catholic priest of the Archdiocese of Indianapolis in Indiana. I am a member of the Indianapolis Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I am an alcoholic. I was ordained to the Catholic priesthood in 1929. And I believe that at that time, I was as sincere in my vocation as any priest that was ever ordained. However, in the back of my mind at that time was a very definite fear. And that fear was that I might become an alcoholic. And the reason for that fear was that my dad had been an alcoholic. I had not known him very well in life. He died when I was only 4.5 years old. But I'd heard the family talk, and I was raised with the conviction that the worst possible person in the world was an alcoholic, and I didn't want to be one. So on the occasion of my ordination, I made a decision. I made a decision that I would not partake of intoxicating beverages for a period of 1 year. Now, why I only said 1 year, I'll never know. I suppose it was the beginning of my rationalizing mind that always liked to keep a door open for future reference. But anyhow, I made such a decision. Well, now it so happened, after the first year in the priesthood, that the Bishop of Indianapolis sent me to New York City to postgraduate in the School of Education at Fordham University. That was during the lush days of Prohibition. And if any of you happened to have been in New York at that time, you would remember that every few days, someone deposited a little pamphlet upon your doorstep. And in that little pamphlet were listed all the various types of liquors and liqueurs and rums and wines and champagnes and what have you, called such and such a number, we deliver within 1 hour, which they did. Everybody drank in New York at that time, both socially and antisocially. And so I rationalized to myself, I thought, well, now this is a wonderful opportunity for me to find out whether I am an alcoholic. So on occasion, I accepted my first highball. Oh, it didn't seem to affect me in any untoward manner at the time. But you know, I can look back now, having had the opportunity to analyze the circumstances much more clearly in these past few years. And I can see from that very first partaking of alcoholic beverages to any extent, that there were very definite and very positive, although very slight, very definite and very positive changes in my attitudes. In my attitude toward God, toward my fellow man, toward my neighbor, toward myself. I think my case was very average. There was no evidence of increase in the beginning, and I came back to Indiana, and I was appointed to teach in high school. Now, that was still during the days of Prohibition. And in Indiana, we didn't have little pamphlets coming up to the doorsteps every few days. We had to drive down to a little town in the southern part of the state, Jasper, and buy it $5 a gallon. And then go to Sears and Roebuck and get a charred cake for $2.98, put that on your radio for 90 days, and you had pretty good liquor. If you couldn't wait 90, 60 didn't do too bad a job. Well, it seems after a few years that the bishop found out that I was drinking much too much for my own good. And he asked me to go to a sanitarium in St. Louis, Missouri. Well, I went to this sanitarium, and there I had my first experience with the psychiatrist. Now, I do not want to decry psychiatry nor psychiatrists. I very definitely feel that we have a great need for good psychiatrists in this world. But anyhow, this individual, he happened to be a very pompous gentleman. I've always been afraid of running into him in some of the groups along the way. And he had me to sit down and he asked me a lot of questions. And I gave him a lot of answers. Some true, mostly false. And then the question, Father, how much do you drink? And my answer, not much at all. Beer once in a while, but it doesn't bother me. Well, he didn't want to make of that. He leaned back and he scratched his head. He said, well, I don't know, Father. He said, you've told me a lot of other things here now for several hours. Now you say you don't drink. He said, I believe you're a hopeless neurotic. He said, what's your bishop's name? I'll call him and tell him so. Well, that frightened me. And I got to the phone before he did. And I called the bishop and called him long distance and told him I was feeling fine again. I'm going to go right back to work. Well, he in his very fatherly way told me to take the train back to New York City, to re-enter Fordham, and to remain there for a master's degree. I went back to New York, and for a period of 10 months, I did not drink. I was afraid to. However, at the end of 10 months, the first week in April, I received my master's degree. In the second week, someone offered me a drinking occasion, and I took it. Again, the increase was not noticeable. I came back again to Indiana. I was appointed as assistant pastor in several parishes, and then I received my first appointment as pastor. I was appointed as pastor of the Little Crossroads Church of Snake Run, Indiana. Which they did. As a matter of fact, I was only pastor there for about 16 months. When the bishop found out that I was drinking much too much for my own good or anybody else's, as far as that goes, and he sent me a letter. And it wasn't too nice a letter either. Because in this letter he told me that he was hereby relieving me of my pastoral appointment and directing that I should return to Indianapolis to be assistant pastor again. Of course, he gave us the reason that he wanted me to be near him, but I never did believe that one. And he also, in this letter, asked me first to go to Sacred Heart Sanitarium in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Well, I went to this sanitarium, and there again I met a psychiatrist. And he again asked me a lot of questions, and I again gave him a lot of answers. Mostly not true. Then the inevitable question, Father, how much do you drink? And the inevitable alcoholic answer, not much at all. Beer once in a while, but it doesn't bother me. Sometimes two beers. Well, you know, that always seemed to stump me. Because he leaned back too and scratched his head. He said, well, I don't know, Father. He said, from all the things that you've told me, we've been sitting here discussing your problems for several hours. And he said, now you say you don't drink. He said, I believe you're a manic depressive. Well, I didn't know what that meant at the time. I remember when I got to my room, I looked it up in the dictionary, and I closed it in a hurry. Because it means, well, it means you're a little bit crazy. But I stayed at this sanitarium for a period of 7 weeks. And then I became restless to go home, and I told the doctor so. And I said, furthermore, doctor, I can go home, and I can do at home everything that I'm doing here. Well, he gave me an answer, which at the time didn't mean very much. But again, since I have had opportunity to analyze his answer much more clearly in these past few years, I can see the wisdom of his answer. And his answer was, Father, you can, but you won't. Which I didn't. I did go back to Indianapolis. But I set about immediately to convince the bishop that he was wrong, that he had made a mistake, that he had misjudged me. I used every opportunity to bring this to his attention, only as an alcoholic can. For 10 months, again, I did not drink. I was afraid to. You know, it seems that fear lasted about 10 months in the upper parts of my consciousness, and then fear left, and so did sobriety. So at the end of 10 months, someone offered me a drink on occasion, and I took it. This time, the increase was very rapid. And right in the middle of it, I get another letter from the bishop. Oh, this was a nice letter. In this letter, he told me that he had been convinced that he had made a mistake. He felt he had misjudged me. And so in order to make up for it, he was hereby appointing me as pastor of a city parish in Indianapolis. Well, of course, I was very much elated by that so-called victory, and that wasn't good at all. I remember the appointment took effect at the beginning of Lent. And I suppose as sort of a subconscious struggle for a bit of honesty, I made up my mind that I wouldn't drink anymore during Lent. I got by 10 days. In fact, I never got by any longer after that. As a matter of fact, I was only pastor at this parish for 12 months. When Bishop found out beyond any shadow of a doubt that he had been right in the first place. And then he sent me a letter that was a honey. And in this letter, he told me to go to a sanitarium in the northern wilds of Wisconsin until further notice. Now, that might have meant 6 months, 6 years, or life, for all I knew. But I, as a priest, and he as my superior and bishop, I had to go. But you know, I had a very close friend to take with me. A friend of long years standing. And that was my rationalizing mind. We sat down, we figured it all out. But, well, I have a car, I can drive up there, and every day I can drive around the countryside and relax. I call a personal friend of mine in Indianapolis and order a case of liquor. I remember it fitted in my Gladstone bag perfectly, six on each side. Of course, you had to take out some clothes, but that wasn't too important. So I rationalized to myself. I thought, well, now I'll have a nice long rest and relaxation out of this. That's been my trouble. I've been working too hard. So off I set to the sanitarium. Well, when I got there, I found out they didn't allow those things there. As a matter of fact, the bishop had sent word that I should dispose of my car immediately, and that I should never again in the future drive nor own a car without his written permission. Well, of course, everything being taken away from me so suddenly, you know, I was a bit upset and nervous and jittery and sick, and I called for a doctor, and I got a psychiatrist. And he asked me a lot of questions, too. And then, Father, how much do you drink? I said, why, doctor, I haven't had a drink since I've been here. 48 hours. Well, he didn't know what to make of it either. He scratched his head and he said, well, I don't know, Father. He said, now, all the other problems we've been discussing between us here, and you say you don't drink. He said, I believe you're a schizophrenic. And he said, I think the shock treatments will help you. Well, I didn't know what either the shock treatments or schizophrenia was. I thought the shock treatments were some kind of massages, you know, to relax one. Well, anyhow, the next afternoon, a limousine came up to the sanitarium. Called for me by name. And I got into the limousine. We drove out into the country. And as we were driving along, I was admiring the beautiful architecture of the various estates as we passed them. However, soon we came to a very large estate. And as I was admiring the buildings, we came to the front entrance. And there over the gate was inscribed in letters of iron, the Wisconsin State Hospital for the Insane. And in we went. Well, I thought this is the end of the road. But I was there, so I took the shock treatments. Eight of them. Oh, they might have quieted my mental upset a bit, I suppose, my nerves somewhat, I don't know. But they had no effect on my alcoholic problem. In fact, I was at this sanitarium for 11 months, and certainly during that time, I had readjusted again to fidelity to prayer and meditation and the various other obligations that we have as priests. So when the bishop sent word that I should report to his office in Indianapolis, I again was very much elated, and that wasn't good. I don't know what I expected. Perhaps I thought he was going to give me a nice big parish for having been up there 11 months. I don't know. But I do remember that I came back to Indianapolis in a very expectant frame of mind, and that was not good. And I went to his office, and I sat down, and he began. He said, well, Ralph, he always called me by my first name. We used to be good friends in the old days. He said, I'll give you another chance. He said, you can go up such and such a parish and live there for a while. He said, I don't know whether the pastor will take you or not. He said, I haven't talked to him as yet. But he says, anyhow, he says, I don't think there's a chance in the world for you. He says, I am convinced you're absolutely hopeless. Well, there I sat. A hopeless, neurotic, manic, depressive, schizophrenic. With the bottom of the world dropped out from under me. Many of you know what that meant. An influx again of fears and phobias and resentments and self-pity and all those things that an alcoholic, and only an alcoholic, can know so deeply and so well. They had never been eliminated from my personality in the past, and now they came to the front in all their vengeance. I was a very much frightened individual when I went to this rectory. I was very much dejected. I was afraid to leave the house. I thought everyone would be pointing their finger of scorn at me, because after all, I had been pastor of a parish next door just 11 months before. However, in spite of all these circumstances, just 7 days after I had returned to Indianapolis from this sanitarium, a friend of mine came to town, called me on the phone, and wanted to know if I'd like to take a ride. He knew I didn't have a car. Those things get around, you know. So I said I would, and he came by the rectory, and I got into the car, and he said, how about a little drink? Well, I thought one little drink won't hurt me. So I took a drink. Well, I don't believe I shall ever forget And I pray God each day that he shall never let me forget that night, and especially the next day. I don't remember where, when, or how the night ended, but I do very vividly recall the next day. I had to be on the job, and I think I took every pill that I could find in the rectory, even all the other good fathers, to get by. I was a very much frightened individual. I believe then it was for the first time that it slowly began to dawn on my conscious thinking that maybe, just maybe, alcohol was my primary problem, and therefore would have first to be solved before all these other real and imaginary problems, which I had always considered much more important and which I had always thought would have first to be solved. As I said, I was frightened, I was nervous, I was jittery, I was sleepless. 2 weeks later, 2 o'clock in the morning, the phone rang. Being awake, I answered it. It was a sick call. I went on the sick call, and I found a man in his bedroom on the floor. I thought he was dead. And I hurriedly prepared to give him the last sacraments as we do in our religion, just as the doctor stooped over and gave him a shot in the arm, and he sat up as live as you and I. And the doctor sort of slyly looked over at me, and he said, "Too much liquor and barbitols." And I thought, the poor fellow. I remember I told his wife, I said, "Well, I can't be a lot of help tonight as a priest. I'll come back later tomorrow when he's feeling better and talk to him." So the next afternoon, I went back to see him. And as I was waiting for him to come downstairs, I happened to look on the mantelpiece. And there was the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, naturally, being interested in anything with an alcoholic label, I took the book down and I started to thumb through it. And as he came downstairs, I said, "Say, what is this Alcoholics Anonymous?" "Oh," he said, "that's a wonderful thing for those who need it." But he said, "I'm a social drinker. I don't need that." Well, I said, "May I take the book home and read it?" He said, "Sure." He was glad to get rid of it. I think his wife had bought it for him. Well, I took the book home and I read it. Oh, immediately I could see a lot of people whom AA would help. As a matter of fact, I thought right away of several of my relatives who should get into AA. But it was not for me, so I put the book aside. The next day, though, curiosity got the better of me. I picked up the book and I read it again. That went on for 3 or 4 weeks. And during those 3 or 4 weeks, I read that book from cover to cover at least 15 or 20 times. I couldn't get away from it, and I couldn't stay with it. As I said, I could see a lot of people whom AA would help, but it was not for me, because after all, I was a Catholic priest. Now, it so happened that the founder of AA in Indiana happened to have been a member of the parish where I was living. And he came to the rectory with some pamphlets about AA to acquaint the priest with the movement. I was interested, and I asked the pastor. I said, "Say, who brought this literature?" "Oh," he said, "that was brought by one of our parishioners. He's a very high type individual." He said, "A very fine character." He says, "I think he's some big shot in Alcoholics Anonymous." He says, "I think he's president or somebody." He didn't know much more about it than I did. But I did put that fact into the middle of my revolving brain that was going around at that time at such a terrific pace with all its facts, fancies, foibles, and phobias. And finally, in sheer desperation, 12 years ago, last November, I picked up the phone and I called this gentleman who had brought the literature to the rectory. Well, he only lived a couple of blocks up the street, and I told him on the phone, I said, "You don't know who I am. I'm one of the priests down at the rectory. But I'm wondering now if sometime, and I'm no hurry about this at all, maybe you could give me a little of your time to talk to you." He said, "I'll be right down." I think he knew more than I thought he did. Well, he got there rather quickly. And getting there so quickly, he caught me unprepared. So I told him about that much of my story. Well, he leaned back in his own inimitable way. And he said, "Well, Father," he said, "I'd suggest you go to a meeting." He said, "You'll learn more from one meeting than you will from me talking to you for days." And I said, "You mean I should go to a meeting?" And I said, "Remember, I'm a priest. And if I go to one of these meetings, what will people think to see a Catholic priest walk into a meeting of a bunch of drunks?" Well, he sort of took a pot shot at my ego by replying. He says, "Well, Father, I don't think they'll think much at all." He said, "Matter of fact, I think they'll have enough things their own think about, think much about you." Well, he had me there. My vanity wouldn't let me say no. So I had to say, yes, I'll go. But inside I thought, well, now I'll go as an interested spectator. And who knows, someday I might be able to help these poor devils out. Well, come meeting night, after I had decided not to go at least a dozen or two times, several of the members came by the rectory and I went to the meeting. Well, again, it seems that divine providence had other designs over and above and beyond my own will, because I had hardly sat down in the meeting when this gentleman stood up and he said, gentlemen, we didn't have any ladies in those days either. He said, I want to introduce a new member. And so I was hooked. And I wasn't very happy about it either. But then I was afraid to quit. I thought, well, they know it now. What will they think if I don't go back? But fortunately, the first year, I stayed dry, and I kept going to the meeting. And as we say in AA, you don't learn AA. AA is not a teaching organization. We say if you stay around AA long enough dry, AA will get you, and you in turn will get AA. And so as the days lengthened into months, and the months into a little over the first year, things began to make sense to me. And the darkness of alcoholism began to give way to the brightness of the peace of mind and serenity that so many know today as members of Alcoholics Anonymous. Life took on new meaning, and life took on real motivation. And tonight, a little over 12 years later, the present Archbishop of Indianapolis not only permits me to own and drive a car, but permits me to drive all the way across the country alone with it. Now, I'm going to try to answer at this point a question which I feel is uppermost in many of your minds, particularly in the minds of our good non-alcoholic friends. And that question is, what did I, as a Catholic priest, get from Alcoholics Anonymous? Particularly since the 12 steps of AA are a spiritual way of living, what was there for me, a priest, who had already spent a lifetime in the study of the spiritual life? Well, I got a lot from Alcoholics Anonymous. I was led to admit once and for all that I am an alcoholic. Not that I was an alcoholic. Not that I am an ex-alcoholic. But I am an alcoholic and therefore will remain an alcoholic until the day I die. Which means that even though I be dry 10, 20, 30, 40 years and take one drink, I cannot guarantee my sobriety. That's what makes me different from the so-called normal individual. Although you know something? We in AA sometimes wonder who's whom in this normalcy business. I also learned that outside of the alcoholic problem itself, there's little difference between me and my fellow man. Now, if you don't believe that, you can go to any AA meeting in the country where it is a public meeting, and there you will find many non-alcoholics and many alcoholics. Now, after the meeting breaks up, just try to pick them out. If you can't smell them, you can't tell them. I also learned that being an alcoholic did not necessarily brand me as a moral degenerate. It simply meant that I was a person that could not tolerate alcohol. If I did not take alcohol, then I could adjust to life just as normally, and even more so, if we could use the term, as any so-called normal individual. I learned that I had a sickness of a threefold character, of mind, body, and soul. And I learned that I must adjust on all three levels, morally, or spiritually, mentally, and physically. If I didn't, I might not stay sober. If I did, I not only would remain sober, but I would be happy and have peace of mind and contentment and live in life as Almighty God meant me to live. I also learned that being an alcoholic, I have a peculiar type nervous system, which means that is in relation to alcohol. That means that there are certain types of emotional circumstances that I cannot tolerate for long. If I do, I'm liable to set off again the compulsion to drink over which I might not have control. Those circumstances are such as resentments, self-pity, over-hunger, over-tiredness, and the like. If I permitted myself to indulge in these circumstances of living too frequently or for too prolonged periods of time, I again would automatically set off that craving for alcohol. I also learned that for the rest of my life, I would be subject to certain cycles. Cycles of depression, shakes, nervousness, sleeplessness, and what have you. But I learned that the solution of these cycles would lie in their acceptance and not in fighting against them. I learned that if I fought against these circumstances of my life, that very conflict might set off the craving for alcohol over which I might not have control. I learned further that I would have about 10,000 to one better chance of retaining these newfound attitudes and this newfound sobriety by remaining among and with individuals who have the same problem that I have than I ever could hope to have on my own. Recalling to mind, if you will remember, the words of the good psychiatrist at the sanitarium when he told me, "Father, you can, but you won't." You know, we don't know why, but for some unknown reason, the alcoholic personality on the average will not, we don't say he cannot, but he will not continue for long along positive lines of sobriety and thinking and living on his own. He could, but he won't. You know, that's the reason when someone asks me, they say, "Well, Father, couldn't the church keep them sober?" They could, but they won't. Couldn't his family keep him sober? It could, but it won't. We don't know why, but the alcoholic will not continue for long along those lines of living. I also learned that for the rest of my life, sobriety must be my primary concern. Not necessarily my basic interest in life, but my primary concern, which means first. And before everything else, I must avoid that first drink. If I don't, I'm not going to be any good to God, to my friends, to my neighbor, to my family, or to myself. I also learned that no matter what problem might arise in my life, no matter how complicated the circumstances of my life might become, that no problem could become too big, nor could the circumstances become too complicated that I would not be able to solve them without the aid of alcohol. Then, too, I learned that one of the reasons that the good professional men of the past who treat alcoholics, the doctors, the psychiatrists, the clergymen, had so little success with the problem is because they did not approach it on the threefold plane of mind, body, and soul. You know what used to happen in the doctor's office? The alcoholic went to the doctor, and what did the doctor say? The doctor said, "If you don't stop drinking, you're going to die." He knew that. And in order to make his death a little more palatable, he got himself another fit. What did the psychiatrist say? Psychiatrists would say, "If you don't stop drinking, you're going crazy." He knew that too. And in order to make insanity a little more bearable, he got himself another fit. What did the clergyman say? "If you don't stop drinking, you're going to hell." He knew that too. And he had been almost there several times. And so to quench a few of the flames, he got himself another fit. All these good men were trying to frighten the alcoholic into sobriety, where we find that the alcoholic's primary problem is a problem of fear and insecurity. And that's one of the reasons, at least in my opinion, that the Alcoholics Anonymous program works so well. Because through a human being is once again set up a contact of confidence. And through that confidence set up in another alcoholic, the alcoholic again gradually engenders confidence in his fellow man and confidence in God, who is the only ultimate source of security and peace of mind and happiness. You know, a lot of people will ask me, why is it that AA works when these other agencies fail? Well, as I said, first of all, they don't approach the problem on the threefold scale of rehabilitation. We have a saying in AA that only the happy alcoholic will stay sober. If the alcoholic doesn't become happy, he's not going to stay sober. Now, with mental conflict, confusion, moral problems, no one's going to remain happy. Then the group therapy, the establishment of the contact of confidence. One alcoholic helping another alcoholic. After all, that's the whole concept of AA. A group of individuals, each helping the other to achieve and maintain happy sobriety. It's as simple as all that. One alcoholic helping hand in hand and shoulder to shoulder with another alcoholic.